वृंदावन धाम की जय, नवद्वीप धाम की जय, जगन्नाथपुरी धाम की जय, गंग माई की जय, जमुन माई की जय, मुक्ति देवी की जय, तुलसी देवी की जय, श्री गौर निताय की जय, श्री श्री राधा मदन मोहन की जय, साम वेद भक्त की जय, और प्रेमानंद ऑल ग्लोरीज टू द असेंबल्ड डिवोटीज, ऑल ग्लोरीज टू द असेंबल्ड डिवोटीज, ऑल ग्लोरीज टू द लोटस फीट ऑफ श्री गुरु एंड गोल्ड Chapter 13, which is entitled Further Talks Between King Rahubana and Jagbharata, otherwise known as the Forest of Material Enjoyment. So this is text number 5. Vadrishya
Vadrishya
Jili
Jili
Swana
Swana
Karna
Karna
Shula
Shula
Luka
Luka
Vagbir
Vagbir
Vyatitantaratma
Vyatitantaratma
Apunya
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 Vrikshan
Vrikshan
Srayate
Srayate
Siddhadito
Siddhadito
Morichi
Morichi
Toyani
Toyani
Abhida Abhidhavati
Abhidhavati
Vachit
Vachit
Adrishya Jili Swanakarna Shula
Adrishya Jili Swanakarna Shula
Uruka Bhabir Vyatitantaratma
Uruka Bhabir Vyatitantaratma
Apunya Vrikshan Srayate Kshudhadito
Apunya Vrikshan Srayate Kshudhadito
Morichito Yanyadidhavati Kvachit
Morichito Yanyadidhavati Kvachit
Adrishya Jhili Swanakarna Shula
Adrishya Jhili Swanakarna Shula
Lukava Girvyatitantaratma
Lukava Girvyatitantaratma
Apunya Vrikshan Sayate Shudhajito
Apunya Vrikshan Sayate Shudhajito
Morichito Yanyabhidavati Kuchit
Marichito Yanyabhidavati Kuchit
Adrishya Jhili Sunnakarna Shula
Adrishya Jhili Sunnakarna Shula
Kava Girvyatitantaratma
Kava Girvyatitantaratma
Apunya Vrikshan Sayate Shudhadito
Apunya Vrikshan Sayate Shudhadito
Morichito Yanyabhidavati Kvachit
Morichito Yanyabhidavati Kvachit
Adrishya Jili
Swanakarna Shula
Adrishya Jili
Swanakarna
Impious trees
that have no fruits or flowers. Srayate,
he takes shelter of.
Shuddha, from hunger.
Arditaha,
suffering.
Marichitoyani,
the waters of a mirage in the desert.
Abhidavati,
he runs after.
Kvachit,
sometimes.
Sometimes.
Translation. Wandering in the forest of the material world, the conditioned soul sometimes hears an invisible cricket making harsh sounds, and his ears become very much aggrieved. Sometimes his heart is pained by the sounds of owls, which are just like the harsh words of his enemies. Sometimes he takes shelter of a tree that has no fruits or flowers. He approaches such a tree due to his strong appetite, and thus he suffers. He would like to acquire water, but he is simply illusioned by a mirage, and he runs after it. Srila Prabhupada's purport. In Srimad Bhagavatam, it is said that the Bhagavat philosophy is meant for people who are completely free from envy, paramo nirmatsaranam. The material world is full of envious people. Even within one's inner circle, there is much backbiting. You know this term, backbiting? Talking about people behind their backs, biting them in the back. And this is compared to the sound vibration of a cricket in the forest. One cannot see the cricket, but one hears its sounds, and thus becomes much aggrieved. When one takes to Krishna consciousness, one always hears unpalatable words from relatives, brainwashed, for example. This is the nature of the world. One cannot avoid mental distress due to the backbiting of envious people. Being very much aggrieved, sometimes one goes to a sinful person for help. But he has no means to help because he has no intelligence. Thus, the living entity is disappointed. This is like running after a mirage in the desert in an effort to find water. Such activities do not produce any tangible results due to being directed by the illusory energy a conditioned soul suffers in so many ways. Ma Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Shumadde Bhakti Vedanta Swami Chitana Namaste Sarasvate Deve Gaurabhari Kichanyan Nirvishesha Sunyavadi Paschachade Sitaran Om Mangyanam Timaranda Shakarandana Shakaya Chatsuru Miritam Jainam Kasmarji Gurave Namaha So, in this chapter, Bharata is trying to tell Maharaj Rahudana of the faults of the material world. And this is called, so he's describing the state of the conditioned soul in the material world, like somebody in a forest, lost in a forest or a jungle. So here in the verse today, just to imagine you're lost in a forest, it's nighttime, and all around you, you hear the sounds of loud insects making loud, shrill sounds all the time. You can't see them. They're called adrishya jivi. They're unseen. You can't see them, but you can hear them. And so loud sometimes you're practically deaf. You can't hear anything else. And also you're disturbed by the sound of the owls, these, you know, knife hunting predator or birds. I think in India, owls are not considered auspicious sounds. Here, everybody likes them because they look so cute, but they're actually they hunt at night. And, they're not cute to the mice and rabbits they kill. So these things, he goes to a tree. He's hungry, but he goes to a tree that is apunya vriksha, impious tree. A tree that has no, bears no fruit or flowers, is considered impious. I don't know why exactly, but why impious. Anyway, then. So here's a hungry person who goes to a tree for fruit, and only trees he finds that bear no fruit. And then he's apt, he's thirsty, hunger and then thirst. But the water he chases after is called marichi toya. You know, marichi, like a magician, creates illusions. So marichi toya is illusory water. This is called a mirage. So you usually see them in desert conditions. Sometimes in the distance it looks like water. You run after it, and it's, when you get there it's gone. We call it a mirage in the desert. So this is in the material world. This stands for what happens here. So here the sound of these invisible insects always chirping are your enemies attacking you behind your back. You hear rumors, oh, so-and-so says this about you, so-and-so is saying that about you. You know they're plotting and scheming and criticizing. But you can't find out, did you say this about me? No, I didn't say this about you. You can't find this out. And sometimes they're like the owls, is very this harsh criticism. So Prabhupada has pointed out that the condition for the Bhagavad philosophy, Nir Matsaranam Satam, Dharma Projita Kaitavo Atra Paramo Nir Matsaranam Satam, this Bhagavad, which is rejecting all kinds of materially motivated dharma, is meant for those who are those souls who are pure in heart, near matsa. There is no anger or envy or enmity toward anyone. They're completely free from all envy, because in the material world is a place of competitive sense gratification. As soon as one is engaged in sense gratification, immediately there are friends and enemies. Friends meaning those that help me in my sense gratification, and enemies, those who stop me or block me in my sense gratification. Because as soon as there's the desire for sense gratification, there is duality of all kinds. There is pleasure, this gives me pleasure, and then whatever gets in the way, then that causes pain. So immediately friends and enemies is a basic thing that goes on in the world. When there's the desire just to enjoy this world, immediately duality comes. And there's always envy, always inimical people. And success in politics in this world is simply regulating the envy. When it's unregulated, it's like Iraq right now. there's a philosopher, English philosopher, 17th century Thomas Hobbes, who described human life as a perpetual state of warfare, because everybody is engaged in competitive sense gratification. And so his philosophy of the reason we have government is that everybody gets one person who's to stop the war of all against all, and turn it into a war of all against the government. So the government is regulates the envy. But then people are also, then there's a problem with the government all the time, because he has all the power. So this is this view, which sometimes is considered pessimistic, that is the nature of that everybody, it's there. It's a world of competitive sense gratification. This is what they call backbiting, talking about people behind their backs. And Prabhupada said, when one takes to Krishna consciousness, one always hears unpalatable words from one's relatives. They tell you right to your face, you're a fool, you're going to ruin your life, you're being brainwashed, and so on, or whatever the current thing is, because materialistic people can't understand this, why you should do this, and they think there's some terrible thing happening to you that you've decided to become, to give up the efforts of competitive sense gratification. We must say that we also find backbiting inside the Hare Krishna movement, unfortunately, although we are supposed to be Nir Matsaranam Satam, but it continues. Actually, I think that this kind of backbiting maybe is a danger with any kind of religious group that have high standards. If you see what goes on among nuns in a convent, this is always a problem. Anywhere there are high standards, this tends to be one of the failures, because psychologically what many times happens in this world, in these circumstances, backbiting, the word Prabhupada uses all the time is fault finding. In other words, one is looking for other people's faults. So that happens because we have accepted very high standards. But what happens to me is that in my heart, I know I'm not, I feel that I'm not adequate. I'm not living up to these standards, and I feel bad about myself. But instead of dealing with this in an honest way, I try to relieve the psychological pressure by thinking, doing something like this, well, I may be really bad, but he's worse, and he's worse, and he's worse, and he's worse, and so on. And I'm not even conscious that I'm doing this sometimes, but I just feel better about myself if I see everyone else is worse. So I was once talking to a householder who was not in very good spiritual shape, and trying to tell him, and he says, "Yeah, but what about all those sannyasis? Who knows what they're doing?" You know, like that. He's thinking all the time of the sins of the sannyasis to feel better about himself. So this is we have to be careful about this. It's true, we have very high standards, and I know, here's what I should be this pure devotee, and I look in my heart and there's all kinds of things that don't belong. So the attitude of a devotee should be frankness, or he should be charlatan is the word, simple. And not duplicitous, not trying to say, yes, I know I have all these problems. I'm certainly a fallen soul, but I will always be trying to get better, and I will stick to the path no matter what. Even if these things are there, I know that sooner or later, by the mercy of the devotees and by the mercy of Lord Chaitanya, these things will go away, and I shall keep on trying. This way, what one should be, instead of trying to maintain one's self-respect by finding fault with other people. This is a wrong thing. So sometimes it comes, it's just a contamination from the material world. The sign of a devotee is they appreciate other devotees. Because without the association of devotees, I cannot make any advancement in Nitya. And so if I see that there are faults in devotees, I should simply say these are... Even if this person is not very advanced, I can appreciate him or her for what he's trying to become. Even not what he is now. I can look for their good qualities and not become obsessed with the bad qualities and so on. This is how we need to do. So, but outside in the material world, there's no hope. Here in our society, we are trying to become free from pride and false ego. In the material society, they are trying to increase pride. Our idea of great soul is someone that's humble. Their idea of a great soul is quite different. Someone who has more and more, and who stands up and says, "I am the greatest." So this is the opposite way for them. And nobody is trying to become humble. Everyone is trying to become better. people are trying to destroy their enemies. They're trying to destroy their friends, too, because very often you have to climb to the top over the knives that you've stuck in the backs of your friends. This is what's going on. So wherever one goes in the material world for relief from the suffering, like you take shelter of a tree that gives no fruit. This is what's said here. You go to people for good advice and they give you bad advice. People have no intelligence, thus the living entity is disappointed. So anyway, this is the, here we, in this whole chapter, we get all this nasty stuff about the material world. Sometimes people are, here I want to, I'll do it like this, let me give this. Prabhupada says that we should have a pessimistic view of the material world. You know, there's these two words in English, maybe also in German, optimism and pessimism. And there are philosophers of these, optimism, the Western philosopher that's considered to be optimistic is Leibniz. Leibniz said that he tries to make a case in his philosophy that this is the best of all possible worlds. It's not the best world that you could imagine, but he tried to show that of all possible worlds, this is the best possible world. This is considered optimism. Who made fun of this philosophy is Voltaire. He wrote a novel called Candide. Maybe you've read this. Sometimes you're forced to read it in school. It's a very funny book about a simple guy who has a teacher who's teaching this Leibniz philosophy, how this is the best of all possible worlds, and Candide just goes through one horrible thing after another. So this is Voltaire, you know, the philosopher of the French Enlightenment and so on. He wrote this, and it's a very, very funny novel, actually. It'll help you become pessimistic. You can read it. But the philosopher of pessimism is always considered to be Schopenhauer, who lived in Frankfurt most of his life. He was the philosopher of pessimism. So there are these two contrasting things, that this world is nice and this world is horrible. Optimism, the word pessimism sometimes is used by exaggerated view of the evils of the world. Or sometimes people are pessimistic out of total hopelessness. Now this is not what we're talking about for Krishna conscious devotee. We are certainly, we are optimistic about our lives because we are not invested in the material world, but pessimistic when it comes to the material world. In the 13th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, there's a list of the items of knowledge. And one is janma, mrityu, jara, vyadi, dukkha, anudoshana. One should know the evils of birth, death, old age, and disease. So Prabhupada says here in his purport, one should try to understand the distress of accepting birth, death, old age, and disease. There are descriptions in various Vedic literatures of birth. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, the world of the unborn, the child stay in the womb of the mother, its sufferings and so on are all very graphically described. It should be thoroughly understood that birth is distressful. Because we forget how much distress we've suffered within the womb of the mother, we do not make any solution to the repetition of birth and death. Similarly, at the time of death, there are all kinds of sufferings, and they are also mentioned in the authoritative scriptures. These should be discussed. As far as disease and old age are concerned, everyone gets practical experience. No one wants to be diseased. No one wants to become old, but there is no avoiding these. Then he says this, unless we have a pessimistic view of this material life, considering the distresses of birth, death, old age, and disease, there is no impetus for our making advancement in spiritual life. So therefore, this pessimistic view of material life is emphasized. I was giving a class in New York City once, and I read this purport, and then during the question, some lady raised her hand, and she really objected. I mean, she was a devotee. I was surprised, but she really objected to this pessimism, and she thought it was unhealthy, and devotees shouldn't have this, and it turned people off, she said, where devotees are so negative, I knew what she meant, because, like, for example, on one of my early visits to the temple, after the Sunday feast, I stood in the doorway of the temple and looked out, and I saw this really beautiful sunset. And there was a devotee girl in a sari next to me, standing there, and I said, oh, what a beautiful sunset. And she said, it is not beautiful, it is horrible. And if you think it's beautiful, and if you think it's beautiful, you'll just have to take birth again to enjoy it. And I thought, what kind of people are these? I thought, you know, like, it was definitely beautiful, you know. I understood her point in a way, you know. But it seemed like there was something wrong. Later I thought, well, there's so many of other things she could have said to make her point. Yes, it is beautiful, but consider how much more beautiful is that for which it came. Or, yes, actually, because the sunset is considered Krishna's dress, you know, the Bhagavatam says, like, something, you know. But anyway, that was the talking about. So, there was a letter. We have a book called Science of Self-Realization. I don't know what it's how it's translated in English, but Prabhupada received a letter from a woman in California in 73, and she complained about the devotees. They have a very negative outlook toward the people they meet. And so her letter, she said, she wrote to him. Her name was Lynn Ludwig. Please accept this letter with love. We have talked to two of your boys at different times. Both have a very negative outlook toward the people they meet. Do not believe this is how it should be. And so on. And she says things like, these boys happen to represent God. This comes from within. Their outlook must have mercy. She says, love is, let it be as it is, with love or not at all, and so on. So he writes her back a long letter. This is a kind of a hippie letter, sort of love is, and so on. And first he explains, I do not know the case, what the circumstances are, but kindly forgive my beloved disciples for any unkindness or indiscretion on their part. After all, to give up one's life completely for serving the Lord is not an easy thing. And Maya, the illusory material energy, tries especially hard to again entrap those who have left her service to become devotees. Therefore, in order to withstand the attack of Maya and remain strong under all conditions of temptation, young or inexperienced devotees in the neophyte stage of devotional service will sometimes adopt an attitude against those things or persons which may possibly be harmful or threatening to their tender devotional creepers. So it's very nice, probably. You realize they may have actually been kind of nasty about somebody. But at the same time, he still calls them beloved disciples and says you should understand what why this works. They may even overindulge in such feelings just to protect themselves. And thus they will appear to some non-devotees who are perhaps themselves still very much enamored of the material energy of Maya to be negative. The devotees may appear negative or pessimistic. Then Prabhupada says, but if the actual fact is that this material world is a miserable, negative place, full of danger at every step, it is dukkalayam ashasvatam, a temporary abode of death, birth, disease, and old age, a home of suffering and pain only. To come to the platform of understanding these things as they are is not very common. And therefore, persons who attain to it are described as great souls. So now he's calling these devotees great souls, huh? Because he says, he quotes from the Bhagavad Gita, Mam upecha punarjanma dukkalayam ashasvatam napnuvanti mahatmanaha samsiddhim paramam gatim. This means that those who have understood that the material worlds are places of misery and temporality, dukkalayam ashasvatam, never return here again because they are mahatmas, the great souls. And because they are mahatmas, the great souls, Krishna keeps them with him because they have qualified themselves to escape this nasty place by becoming his pure devotees. This verse is spoken by Krishna or God himself in the Bhagavad Gita. Who can be a more final authority? In other words, God himself who made this world certifies dukkalayam ashasvatam. It is miserable and temporary. So that's the best authority. When the maker says, this is miserable and temporary, you better believe it. The point is, to make advancement in spiritual life, one must view everything material with a pessimistic eye, unless it is utilized to serve and please Krishna. So we always have this unless. We are not world-rejecting people like the Mayavadis. Actually, if you think we are pessimistic, Mayavadi philosophy, as is actually stated by Shankaracharya, is utterly and totally negative about this world. It is useless for any purpose whatsoever. In fact, it is so useless, it doesn't exist. Now, you meet people who say they're Mayavadis, but they don't have this, they still want to say there's something good in the world, but these are usually Mayavadis who are at the same time sense gratifiers, which is an unusual but common position. So he says that one should see everything with a pessimistic eye, but if it can be used to serve Krishna, then we like it. We are not very much hopeful for any lasting pleasure or satisfaction for our deepest cravings within this realm of gross matter. That's a great sentence. We are not very much hopeful for any lasting pleasure. We should know that it's all temporary. All pleasure comes to an end. or satisfaction for our deepest cravings. We look for things to satisfy it, and we find we're still unsatisfied. They don't meet our deepest needs. Because our deepest needs is the things that are eternal. So we are not very much hopeful for any lasting pleasure or satisfaction for our deepest cravings within this realm of gross matter. Now, of course, we have an alternative. In that sense, we are very optimistic. In fact, we're very optimistic people. We have this Vaishnava Christian dialogue every year near Washington, D.C. A group of devotees meet with a group of Christians. It's been going on for almost 10 years now. And it's been very, very good developing things. Anyway, the last time we ended up talking in some ways about hell or hells, and the Christian has this idea of eternal hell. We have one Vaishnava in our group who's from the Madhva Sampradaya. They believe the same thing. You know, those verses in the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna says the demons, they go down and down, and you know, put them in perpetually. The Madhvites believe this is always, just people stay in hell forever and never come out. So I said about followers of Chaitanya, we believe that eventually people go to hell for a very, very long time. Practically, it may seem like forever, but it's not. That ultimately, everyone goes back to Godhead. This is a material world. That Krishna will never be satisfied if any of his, those who are his part and parcel of him are permanently alienated or estranged. He wants them all back. So we think ultimately, everyone will go back to Godhead in the material world. Of course, it doesn't mean the material world comes to an end, because as soon as one bunch goes out, another bunch comes in again. But I said, so we believe that everyone goes back to Godhead. We are very optimistic. Our philosophy is no soul left behind. In America, the government making big proposition, big proposals for educational reform, and they call it no child left behind. So you can see. Our philosophy is no soul left behind, like that, which is true. So we, in that sense, we're very much more optimistic than many people. So Prabhupada, everywhere you go, you can see these discussions like this. I'll read a few more. Prabhupada writes, human life is by nature full of suffering, and the lower life forms are even more miserable. Any sane man with properly discriminating senses can understand that life in the material world is full of miseries, and that no one is free from the actions and reactions of these miseries. This is not a pessimistic view of life, but it is an actual fact. In other words, I'm not exaggerating. Sometimes he calls it pessimism, but if you take pessimistic in the negative sense, that it's some exaggeration, that you're making things worse, he's saying, no, this is not a pessimistic view of life, but an actual fact, which we should not be blind to. If there's some danger and you don't see the danger, then you're a fool. But the nature of the material world is such that people deliberately become foolish. In order to be happy, they have to make themselves stupid. And if we look at the material world without any of our blinders, it's quite terrible. I mean, we think, it's so nice here, we are an advanced country, everyone's happy, we are economically prosperous, we read in the newspaper, Sudan, different places, how people are suffering all the time. But it's nice here. There they're dying. Here no one's dying. We think this is nice. But we just don't see it. Right now, you know, just around us, there's this vast mortality going on. People are dying. It's just like a war. It's just like a war. If you see, you'll find every day people are suffering and dying. Now we've got them off in hospitals. You don't see them. They're not lying in the streets, visible to everybody. But it's going on all the time around. This vast mortality. It's just like a war, only it's not so clear. War is just ordinary life speeded up a little bit. And where you have to notice what's going on, but actually that's what the world is like. But if we actually think about it, and if you think about the way this world is, and you have no spiritual understanding of anything different, you'll go crazy. That's why Pascal, the French philosopher, he said that, human beings aren't so necessarily mad, meaning insane. He said people are so necessarily mad that not to be mad is another form of madness. So there's this consensual illusion that everything is nice. We sit down, we enjoy our beer and our schnitzel, you know, and this is, life is good. So we are blind. And if you try to tell people that you're spoiling the party, so Prabhupada says the miseries of life are divided into three categories, namely miseries arising from the body and mind, misery arising from other living entities, miseries arising due to natural calamities. A sane man must look to eliminate these miseries and thereby become happy in this life. We are all trying to achieve peace and freedom from these miseries, at least unconsciously. And in the higher intellectual circles, there are attempts to get rid of these miseries by ingenious plans and designs. So you can have to say these threefold miseries, actually everybody, why so much big medical science? To get rid of disease. And what are they promising? To stop death. They're hoping to get rid of old age. Really, the same things. People are working, spending so much money, and they promise like this. I was told when I was a child that by this date arrived, there would be no more cancer because there was a war on cancer. That there was no more. See, we had penicillin, so no more infectious diseases. Now they've come back, you know. Extreme drug-resistant tuberculosis is back. It's the 19th century all over again. All these, but we are going to get rid of disease. And then there are new ones, AIDS and all this other stuff. They've come back. More diseases. Prabhupada has said these things will never be gotten rid of. When people first read this in 1966, they thought, well, what's he talking about? You know, we have medical science. And there's a statistic in America that 40% of all diseases and they use this word, iatrogenetic. Iatros is the Greek word for physician. They like to use the Greek word because what iatrogenetic means, 40% of all diseases are caused by doctors. Medical treatment. So if you say iatrogenetic, nobody has to believe it. What it is. So the disease is still there. Old age is still there. They're doing research, you know, in the aging process. They find out, I was reading about this, that a cell starts to grow old because there's some chemical switch has gone. They found out this chemical switch, and then the cell starts to age. You know, one cell starts to age because of some. And so first I was reading they're going to find out this chemical switch and figure out another way to flick it back, like a light switch, you turn it back. And so then I read a few years later, they found a way to turn it back. And a big announcement, you know, the big triumph. And then, this was on the front pages of the paper, then in the back pages, 2 years later, yeah, they took a bunch of mice and they genetically engineered so that the switch would to go old would stop, would not turn that direction. But they all got cancer. back to the drawing board, as you say. So they're making plans like this, but it's not working. The people are trying to get free from them, and they are failing. Because we want eternal life. What do we want? What are our deepest needs? Well, I can tell you right now, I want eternal life. I want full knowledge of everything. I don't want to be confused anymore. I want to know what the future brings, so I want eternal life, full of knowledge, and of course I want pure bliss all the time. Naturally, that's what I want. You can prove to anybody that they want these things. It's very simple. This is what you do. You say, you bring your senses into contact with an object, you feel some pleasure, right? But then that pleasure comes to an end. How do you feel when that pleasure comes to an end? Well, you say, I feel bad. Or even if they're really attached, not just bad, I feel suicidal, I feel grief, I feel intense suffering. So why do you feel bad when your pleasure comes to an end? Well, the answer has to be because I wanted it to keep on going. And then if you ask, and how long did you want to keep on going? They say, well, how long could I have? Forever? That's our real desire. So what kind of stupidity is it when I'm looking for happiness that doesn't end in a place where it's all temporary? It just won't work. An incompatible situation. People, why don't they see this simple thing? Because they have to lie to each other. Therefore, they have popular songs, our love will last forever, our love will never die, and so on. It's all a lie, it's self-hypnosis. So when we try to tell people these things, sometimes it's unwelcome news, it's bad news. You know? And in the old days, you know, when messengers used to tell the king, you know, our army has been defeated, so they kill the messenger. So you have to be careful, you have to be a little tactful in telling people about these things. But they must know it. They must know it. If you don't know it, then as Prabhupada said, there's no push, no impetus towards spiritual life. You have to become pessimistic. The first of Buddha had four noble truths. The first one is life is suffering. We don't get to that point. We think we'll go on like idiots. For a devotee, I want to just conclude with a little optimism. For a devotee, there's this nice verse by Prabodhananda Saraswati, who's talking about what happens to a person who has received Gauram Karuna Kataksha, the merciful sidelong glance of Lord Chaitanya. To that person who's received the merciful glance of Lord Chaitanya, Kaivalyam Narakayate, that is impersonal liberation, looks like hell. Tidashapur Akasha Pushpayate, the realms of the demigods looks like illusion, like flowers in the sky. That the senses, which are like venomous snakes, poisonous snakes, their fangs have been removed. They no longer cause trouble. Oh yeah, and here it is, Vishwampurnasukhayate, that the Vishwampurnasukhayate, the whole universe becomes full of happiness. The whole material world looks like a wonderful place. This is because for a devotee personally, once one is in Krishna consciousness, there's no danger from the material. I'm not here to enjoy it. Therefore, I'll not suffer from it. I have my happiness is not linked to anything in the material world. It doesn't depend upon the course of material nature. And therefore, all I see, everything here, and everywhere I look, I see Krishna. Prabhupada said in one lecture, don't see a tree, see Krishna. But this is Krishna's tree everywhere. Krishna has made this world. And so actually, Vishwapurnasukhayate, even the whole material universes, seems like a place of happiness. Naturally, if a devotee has compassion, he notices that there are people who don't see this. These are people who are in Maya. For them, it is all a place of suffering. And we should try to help them. And we have to be compassionate. We should not. But they're suffering because they don't see Krishna. Bhagavatam says that fear arises from the perception that there is something other than Krishna, that there is some second thing, titiya. That's why fear comes. So once one becomes Krishna consciousness, there's nothing to fear. But people are fearful everywhere, because they think they can only live by preserving this body in this world of destruction. You know, naturally you're going to be terrified. If you're not terrified, something's wrong with you. If you identify with your body, then we say they're fools. They're necessarily mad. So we have to wake them up from this foolishness so they can understand that when the actual position of Krishna consciousness is one of fearlessness, and of happiness under any condition in life. That's possible. So these chapters, like this chapter, we should understand it completely. We should remind ourselves, in case there's any chance of becoming again befooled by material nature, illusioned by material nature, enraptured by material nature, we understand what that's like. And help other peoples to get out of this mess that we're all in. Okay, any questions? Yes, Mara.
I want to thank you very much for this well thought through presentation. I have one. It's really very helpful, and as you quoted from Srila Prabhupada, it really. It gives an impetus, this understanding, to advance. I want to ask you a question on the purport where Srila Prabhupada spoke about, he's quoted this verse, that Srimad Bhagavatam is for the non-envious. Mm-hmm. Envy is a great problem also in our society, mm-hmm. as you have mm-hmm. remarked. And could you maybe give your if you would have to say make a training center for devotees who have recognized envy as a problem, what would be the classes they have to go through to become free from envy? Mm. How I'm looking a little bit of a step-by-step mm-hmm. Cure for them, because Yudhishthira Maharaj when he is asked by the yaksha, what is envy? He says it's a sadness of the heart. It's really in your own insecurity, if you want to say it in modern language, that makes you envious of others' successes.
Yes, thank you. That's a good point. I've thought about this a lot also. It was important for me to realize that coming to terms with our sadness of heart and our own bad feelings about ourselves is part of the process of cultivating the holy names. And it's in the Shishastika prayers. Mama dudaiva nidishamiha janinanu raga. Mahaprabhu says, representing himself as a conditioned soul. He's saying, look what you've done. You've given me so many names. You put all your potencies in them. You've made it easy to chant. But something is really wrong with me. Because I have this misfortune, and in spite of all this, I'm not interested. If we're not super enthusiastic and fired up and appreciative about the holy names, that means there's something wrong with me. So our position is also, we have to recognize and come to terms with the fact that we're in the material world. And why are we in the material world? What are we doing here? Why have we been here? Prabhupada says that we're all criminals. I suddenly had to recognize that I'm a criminal. And what is my crime? That I turned away from Krishna. There's a broken relationship, and that's why I'm in the material world. Now, usually when there's a broken relationship in the material world, you know, you go to a marriage counselor, he points out there's faults on both sides. We don't have... in our relationship with Krishna, we have to say it's all my fault. In fact, if by chanting we gain some appreciation for Krishna, then I can only feel completely horrible about myself. And I think Dudaiva Mama Dudaiva Midisha Miha Jani Nani Raga means that we have to go through this as part of the process of chanting. Now, my own experience with this, the propaganda was chant and be happy, which is certainly not wrong. I mean, it's true, we should chant and be happy, but you're just supposed to be blissful. And in the course of time, I realized at a certain point in my career that nobody had really properly taught me how to chant the holy name. And kind of the attitude when I joined was, your japa was something you got through so you could go out on book distribution. It was like something you just had to do and get it over with, you know. It's important, and you had to do it, but still it wasn't, you know. At a certain point I became very interested in chanting the holy name and began to understand. Anyway, I started to really try to chant attentively and keep bringing my mind back and when it wandered away. Then I noticed how I was starting to feel some mental discomfort from chanting. And I was afraid to tell anybody about this, because in those days what they would say is, well, that must mean you're a demon. And I thought maybe I was, you know, why should I be chanting and feel this mental unease? Anyway, so I just decided on my own that I would just tolerate that feeling and just keep on chanting. So I did how long it took, a week or two. And then one day, all of a sudden, this distress just increased, and suddenly it came out in this like this uprush, this fountain of overwhelming grief and sorrow. And I knew immediately what it was, that I had turned away from Krishna and come to the material world. And I just saw this as the most horrible, unforgivable crime. I was so crushed. And again, I couldn't communicate this to anybody because they would again tell me I was a demon, which at this point I would agree with completely. But the saving point was that I had this feeling, but I was chanting the Hare Krishna mantra. And in fact, it was because I was chanting the Hare Krishna mantra that I had this feeling. So I realized that it was, one, good that I had this feeling, and two, that although I had turned away from Krishna, Krishna had not turned away from me. And suddenly my feelings for Krishna and real love is just, that started to increase, you know. So there are these, and I think within something like this, at least is the beginning, because Durdaiva Nidrishami Hajani Nanu Raga, what's the next verse? Trinada Pisumi Chena. So that's, without this Durdaiva, you know, then you start to really become, at least get some idea of what it means to be humble. And one discovers also that there's two things, there's love of God and there's humility. And look at it like this, as humility goes this way, love of God goes this way. You know, and as love of God has no upper limit, and humility actually has no lower limit, you can just keep going like this. And when that process begins, then all of a sudden, envy of other people just starts to vanish. Now, this is when it comes from the heart, and when it comes out of some experience with the Holy Name. This is not, by the way, a very advanced realization. I mean, this is just the second verse of the Shastika verse. So we should at least come to this point. And there's a long way to go in cultivating the Holy Name. Because a lot of times envy of other people is when we don't really want to come to terms with our own faults and our own defects. We have to deal with our own sense of personal failure in a healthy way. The sense of personal failure is not unhealthy in itself, but I should use it. And my sense of my personal failings and weaknesses, I have to acknowledge it frankly, and then take the steps necessary to advance in Krishna consciousness. And I think those steps are first of all acknowledgement or confession, right? I admit it to myself. Forgiveness, that is, in the process of chanting the Holy Name, one understands right away that Krishna is not holding it against me. Even though I've done all these things, I'm still chanting the Hare Krishna mantra. Prabhupada went through so much to rescue us that, you know, Krishna has moved heaven and earth to save me. He's really gone out of his way to bring me back. And so we understand that also there's forgiveness. That Krishna is not sending me to hell forever, even though that would be a just punishment. And therefore there's reconciliation. Then the relationship with Krishna again becomes reestablished through those steps. I think that's built into the process of chanting. These steps, but it has to begin with honest acknowledgement of my own difficulties. If I'm afraid to do that, then I have to build up a false ego, pretend to be something else. I'm a big deal. This, that, the other thing. In the material world, they're doing it, and we do it in Krishna consciousness too. There's spiritual advancement, but sometimes I can substitute other things for it. I can become a big donor. I can distribute many books. I can have temples built. So many ways. Not that these things are bad, but they're sometimes a substitution for the real thing. And if I make an empire out of those things, eventually it'll collapse. out of avoiding, substituting another form of advancement for real spiritual advancement. Okay?
Thank you.
You want to add something to that?
Just a question. What were your two steps? Honest acknowledgement?
Yeah, acknowledgement or confession. This is also the Christian tradition. You know, I think any serious theistic tradition has this confession or acknowledgement. Forgiveness.
By Krishna to you.
By Krishna to you, or Krishna's agents. Yeah, somebody who represents Krishna for us. And reconciliation. That is the. You see, look. Let me. There's really kind of two answers to the question of what is our suffering. In the non-theistic traditions of transcendentalists, like the Buddhists or the Mayavadis, it's ignorance. Right? We're suffering because we're ignorant. When there's a personal dimension to it. It's not just ignorance, but it's sin. Sin means a broken relationship. A broken relationship between me and God. That's really what sin is. It has this personal dimension. That's why people love Buddhism, right? I'm just ignorant, but I didn't do anything wrong. They're attracted to it. So we say the ignorance comes from this breaking the relationship. Behind that is this broken relationship with Krishna. So we have to restore the relationship, not just in theory. In some sense, by coming to Krishna consciousness, by accepting the process of devotional service, by having a spiritual master, we're making the steps toward that. But ultimately, when a relationship with Krishna is fully restored, we're in Goloka Vrindavan. That's Krishna Prema. So everything is steps on toward this. There's reconciliation. You know what? You know what's the German for reconciliation?
Wiedergutmachung.
That has to happen. That has to take place. So how can that take place? Well, first I have to say, this is my fault. That's confession. I have done this. Some places they go to a priest and they confess. And of course, many times it's just an empty ritual. It doesn't really do anything. It has to be heartfelt. I have to say, these are my sins. These are my defects. I have to accept responsibility. But if we do this honestly with Krishna, then there's forgiveness. If we don't actually go to the confession, then we're keeping up a bluff, and then there's not a restoration of a relationship. Well, there's forgiveness and reconciliation. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
On the way to Amsterdam, I talked with Taras about the whole hell thing.
The whole hell thing.
So this is like the one thing I never really understood in Krishna consciousness, that you live a sinful life, murder, kill, rape, eat animals, all that, lie, steal, you're like a real devil. And then, I mean, spending in hell, I read about some places, spending 1 week there might be a hard punishment. but then this whole evolution of consciousness, you get in the lowest species of life and then you have to work yourself up. I was thinking about insects, for example. There's something like a million different kinds. Mm. So this practically means you get eaten alive like every time. Isn't it? And so the whole thing, this whole thing looks like the punishment might not be on the same level, like you said.
Well, on the other hand, you might discover from the punishment just how bad the sins were. The punishment is there. I mean, only human beings go to hell. There's a saying in English which goes to those, from those to whom much has been given, yeah, from those to whom much has been given, much is expected. So it's the higher the human life, the consciousness, we're supposed to make something of it. We're not supposed to spoil the human form of life. It doesn't sound so bad to us because we're in a sinful culture. We don't see things as we are. Our mother thinks that she's doing good when she gives meat to her child because she's making him healthy. People think they're doing the right thing when they're aborting children. I mean, so many things that we do that are so sinful. Well, we're just so used to them. We just think it's normal human life, and it doesn't look so bad to us. And we've made it invisible. Take all these meat-eating countries. You know, take everybody who sits down every day to some chicken or beef in such huge quantities, and just say, okay, you can eat all the same meat. Here's a knife, here's a cleaver, there's a cow, go kill it. You just, whatever you eat, you kill yourself. Go ahead. They'll soon find out what they're doing. but because we've got it all, so all this stuff is hidden away, out of sight. We have other people do it. The upper classes have the lower classes, and the lower classes are so numb they don't care. So we think that many of the things we do, we're just so used to seeing people eating the hamburger and the hot dog and all this other stuff, it can't be that bad. But it's really, really terrible. It's really, really awful what goes on. The descriptions of the hells are terrible. We may wonder, why does God have to do it this way? But all I can say is, you know, I'm not in a position to judge how he does it. I once asked Prabhupada on a walk, I said, Krishna is all powerful. Why does he need so many demons? Why does he need so many demigods to run the universe if he's all powerful? Why, you know, these millions of demigods. He probably just looked at me and says, you don't know how to run a universe. And I had to say, yeah, that's true. So I'm just, you know, whatever Krishna's doing is so far above my station that I have no position to judge. And I have to say to Krishna, whatever you do, I agree with. Yeah.
I want to ask you about one observation which I have made. I fully agree with what you said on pessimism and how it is so important. This is there by Krishna and the Gita, and we all know from practical experience, if you really feel this world, I have seen it again, it really stinks, you know. Mm-hmm. It cannot give me satisfaction. It's really an impetus for spiritual life. We all know from practical experience. This illusionment is very, very healthy. Now, having said this much, I want to enter into another area of philosophy. I feel they are not necessarily connected, and to bring them, to tie them together will hamper intellectual thinking. It is a fact that a person who thinks about negative things, these negative, this force come to him. In the Mahabharata, there are many shlokas about why the fault finder is my greatest friend. Because the fault finder will think about my faults, and by thinking, these faults, my faults go to him, provided I forgive him for his for his fault finding thing. There's a statement like this. There are other statements which say that as you engage your mind about these negative things, you will actually give them strength, and practical experience also tells us those persons, I know some Swamis who really were good in analyzing the faults of the female nature. They really were excellent psychoanalysts, but they had to marry at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you think about this, the thing, and give it so much attention, it does come to you. Now I personally, I'm taking now this observation, to please comment on that observation, but now I will draw a conclusion where you might also, where you also please comment. My conclusion really has become that while I need to be very realistic about the troubles of material life, I really need to engage my mind in something transcendental.
Exactly.
Because if I just do this negative analysis, then I'm finished. I can't advance, really. It may be an impetus,
exactly,
but to do the real thing.
Yeah, the excerpt I read from Prabhupada's letter to this lady, he clearly said that this is necessary for the beginning, but that these people are it's an impetus for their spiritual process. Now, if their spiritual process becomes blocked in some way, then you get a pathology. If there's no spiritual process, then exactly what you say happens. And this blocked spiritual process, it ends up being persecution, heretics or Jews, or blowing up the jihadist terrorists. V.S. Naipaul, the writer, he said that these terrorists who are attacking America, they want two things. They want America to be destroyed, and they want green cards. in other words, this hatred is your overcompensation for your own unacknowledged attraction. If originally you may be right in saying the material world is evil, but then at the same time you're not taking a process to purify you of your attachments, then you become some kind of psychological or a social pathology results in this. So the important thing is we have to see this as one part of a larger process, where the attraction for Krishna has to be there, and there has to be some satisfaction in spiritual life. Otherwise, the bad reputation of religion comes from this. When there's no positive spiritual advancement, when the denunciations of the world or of evil are there, and then you end up hunting witches and burning Jews and whatever, you project your sins onto. This is called projection, where you, your own faults, now you see them all out in the world. That's why Prabhupada said, when your finger is pointing at someone else, you should look at the three fingers that are pointing back at you. It's autobiography. I've also noticed, by the way, that in many cases when people talk about ISKCON, there's so much autobiography in that. Is they're really talking about themselves, whether. One should understand these mechanisms very, very clearly, and we just stop at this. I mean, in the early stages of our movement, I mean, there were a bunch of sannyasis in America that if they had their way, ISKCON would have been the Taliban. I mean, there's no question about it. they were going to send all the women in America to Australia, and I mean, it was just so far out. You know? But, you know, so some people made spiritual progress, so it didn't quite happen. Okay, we should stop now. We have a meeting here to get to. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
So, bitte schön, Leute.